Live from the Allstate Showcase Studio, this is the Steve Cochran Show on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Yeah. 612, want to wish Todd Manley well, one of our fearless leaders, on the mend after a rough couple of days. He'll be fine. He's having a gender reassignment surgery. I probably didn't mention that to
him. No.
Oh, he's really? Not?
No, I don't think
I thought that was it.
I don't think he wanted that part.
Well, I didn't say
that
out loud.
That part, literally.
Oh. Yeah. Here's your, before we get to Paul Conrad, is Paul working today? Yes? Okay. Before we get to Paul Conrad at Channel 9, here's your summation of politics. Trump is still nuts. Hillary is trying now to ignore a book by a Secret Service agent that says she's nuts. This is a Secret Service agent that was in the Clinton White House in the 90s. And Bernie Sanders won't go away and is the Glenn Close in the bathtub. That's your summation so far. All right, let's go to Paul Conrad, live from Channel 9.
Hello.
Hi, buddy.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Nice weekend for you?
Yeah, it was fine, but we need your theme music. Stand by. Here we go.
Yeah, thank you. That's nice. I like that music.
Tender.
It is.
Kinda so we're bailing out of the show today at 9 o'clock
good
to go play golf.
It's good. Work.
Yeah. And
why?
You know, you guys have 50 or 60 people on that show. I mean, you're phoning it in every day, so you know
right.
what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Did you ever lie to get out of work?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
Oh, you still do?
Yeah.
All right. So let's pretend I'm calling you to see where you are.
Yep.
Are you going to do like a fake sickness thing?
No, I just come right out and I say, listen, I have explosive diarrhea, and listen, I can't be there.
There's not
a
single place of work in America that would go, well, come in and tough it out.
Right, yeah. And they just want to hang up right away.
Yeah.
And so now what I've asked them to do when I call in sick, and I'm not really sick, I say, hey, listen, I've got explosive diarrhea. Send a mass email out to everyone, let them know I won't be in. And, like, it's incredibly awkward for whoever is on the other end of the phone, and they just say okay, and
they say something like get well, but don't ever talk to me again.
Right?
Yeah.
So it works.
Isn't it interesting that you've reached an age where you're not even remotely embarrassed about that?
There's no shame, you know. God created our body parts.
Yeah, and when you come up with a fake illness, no matter how embarrassing it is, you got to get behind it.
Right? Yeah. Who cares? Right? You're in it to get the day off.
Right.
You're not worried about what other people think about you.
No.
So I really try to do that as often as I can. I'm known as the guy with explosive diarrhea around here.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that's how Paul and I met. We were in a band called Explosive Diarrhea.
That is so gross.
Right. Yeah, see? Look, it's working already. She wants to change the subject.
That's right.
People just want to get away from that. They don't want to think twice of it.
Well, it's funny you mention your ailment because I get a lot of people, they stop me on the street, they say, Steve, and I say, what? And then they say, tell me more about Paul. So, Paul, take us through your day just quickly here. When do you start work?
I start
the alarm goes off at what time?
2:30.
2:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
And you're out the door at what time?
I get into the office here about 4:30.
It takes you 2 hours from downtown Chicago?
Well, I've been doing this thing where I'm taking long baths.
Like luxurious soaks?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I get up and I lay in a bathtub, and I've been doing this thing where I'm trying to get variations of water temperatures. Sometimes I go really hot. Sometimes I go really cold and I put ice in there. And then sometimes I do lukewarm.
All right. So at 9 o'clock, the show's over. Then what happens?
And then I try to do this 3 times a day.
Oh, more baths?
Yeah. So I get home and then the second bath I've been adding, instead of doing a variation on water temperatures, I add different things into the water.
Bath salts or condiments?
Condiments like beans. I had Ritz crackers in there this last weekend.
Right.
Like soup.
Lavender petals.
Yeah, sure.
You know,
soup.
Anything to try to get the different aromas going.
And then what time do you go to bed?
And then I get to bed by 10 o'clock every night, come rain or shine, and I take one more bath once all the kids are down.
So you only sleep 4.5 hours.
That's all you need. I think
I think that explains a lot.
Yeah. So the last bath, sometimes, you know, what I like to do is invite some of my neighbors in to sit next to me And then I have a conversation with them, and I light some candles.
That's not uncomfortable at all.
And most of the time, I'm turned on. I will be honest.
Yeah. Well, why wouldn't you be?
99% of the time.
Yeah. You realize all this is on the air.
Yeah. Yeah. So listen, I just want to challenge people. Don't be shy.
Bath it up.
Take a bath.
Bath it up,
They're
people.
So out right now, but my life has changed. So that's 3.5 hours a day that I'm bathing. That might be hard for some other people to pull that off.
I think this really has opened a lot of people's eyes to what you're all about.
Yeah, and my skin has never been softer. Mm-hmm. The makeup artist in here always says to me, Paul, you have the best skin. How do you do it? And it's these baths.
Yeah.
So listen, when you're figuring out your schedule for the week, just put in there 3 hours a day of bathing and then start looking through your pantries, see what kind of stuff is in there,
mm-hmm.
like rice. There's all kinds of things that you can bathe with that people don't think about bathing
so
with.
So you're really making an experience.
Yeah, pinto beans. I tried pinto beans last Wednesday. And let me just tell you, the smell that those leave you with is really interesting.
Yeah, that comes from old Ford Pintos.
Yeah.
That's where they make
the backseat of Ford Pintos.
Yeah, that's where
a lot of people aren't aware of that. Thanks, Steve, for knowing that.
All right, now listen, Paul.
Yeah.
You've got to go do the weather on TV. But
yeah.
I just want you to know I really appreciate this little look behind the scenes in your life.
Listen, the pleasure's all mine. What I feel like is that God has blessed me with such an abundant life that it'd be selfish of me to not share some of these little secrets and tidbits that bring me so much joy. I feel like I need to pass them on to other people who maybe are struggling. They don't, I feel like I bring hope to the hopeless.
Is there any reason the audience hates us? You take 3 baths a day and I'm leaving work at 9 to go play golf.
I can't think of one reason.
All right. Thank you, buddy.
All right. Gotta go.
Okay.
Love
bye-bye.
You.
Love you
bye-bye.
Back. There you go. That's Paul Conrad. Something very wrong with him.
Yeah.
I mean, we need like a full medical check.
Normally
we need to get people in there. We need to hook them up to stuff.
Normally you would take a bath maybe after work instead of 2 hours beforehand. But hey, to each his own, right?
He apparently had a tub put in at Channel 9.
With his neighbors.
I don't know how you guys haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it. Have you, Dave?
No.
Six.
You must have missed that.
Maybe it's Skilling's tub. Maybe it's like a weather tub that they share. So there's some confusion as to why Bernie Sanders won't step aside when Hillary Clinton's 20-some-odd delegates away from wrapping it up. The reason is wrapping it up includes the superdelegates, which Bernie Sanders has had a problem with for a long time now. The problem with Bernie Sanders' problem is the superdelegate rules were in place when he got into this race, and he knew what he was getting into at the time. I'm sure after spending at 74 years old, or whatever age you may be, an entire year of your life going 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, it's very tough to give it up and to step out of the spotlight. I mean, if every time you walk to a microphone, people cheer, it's hard to give that up. So Bernie Sanders probably doesn't want to go back to being Bernie Sanders, and that's understandable. Then it's just soup. So the situation he finds himself in is he needs to win California with a thumping. I mean, a big 15-20 point win, and there's nothing in the polls that indicate that's going to happen. If Hillary Clinton wins tomorrow in any way, shape, or form, she's got it wrapped up and his momentum, such that it was, is gone. If she loses but loses close because of the proportional allocation of the delegates, it's still not a momentum swing for Bernie Sanders. So over the weekend, he said there's going to be a contested convention. And by the way, how about contested convention in Philly but not in Cleveland? No, it doesn't make any sense.
Did you see that coming?
No, of course not. So a contested convention is very unlikely to happen for the obvious reasons. The superdelegates are the leaders of the party who would most benefit from the party being unified behind the candidate that got the most votes. So why would they switch to Bernie now?
Right. And think about what's going on now, too. The Republicans are trying to unify, albeit, in some strange way, but they're trying to get their act back together. The Democrats are now starting, they're continuing this chinking away.
And here's the thing about the Democrats fighting with each other is it takes all of the onus off Hillary Clinton's speech last week, which is pretty good.
It was a good speech.
She laid out the great fear of having Trump sit in the Oval Office. Trump, meanwhile, over the weekend didn't do himself any favors. But then again, this will probably pop his poll numbers another 10%. This judge in the Trump University case is from Indiana. He is a Mexican-American from Indiana. He's born here. His parents actually came to America 7 years before Trump's parents, or Trump's grandparents, I should say. So in other words, his family got here faster than Trump's family did, and his family became citizens by way of birth, just like Trump did. Mm-hmm. So for Donald Trump to take the stand he's taken is ridiculous, yet yesterday with Jake Tapper, he just can't give it up.
I have had horrible rulings. I've been treated very unfairly by this judge. Now, this judge is of Mexican heritage. I'm building a wall.
So no Mexican judge could ever be involved in a case that involves you?
He's a member of a society where, you know, very pro-Mexico, and that's fine. It's all fine.
But except I think, that you're calling into question his heritage.
I think he
heritage.
Should recuse himself.
Because he's
then
Latino.
Then you also say, does he know the lawyer on the other side? I mean, does he know the lawyer? You know, a lot of people say
but
yes.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about
that's
like,
another. That's another problem.
But you're invoking his race when talking about whether or not he can do his job.
I'm building a wall. I'm trying to keep business out of Mexico. Mexico's fine. There's nothing.
But he's American. He's an American.
He's of Mexican heritage, and he's very proud of it, as I am where I come
but
from.
But he's
my
an
parents.
American. You keep talking about.
Jake.
It's a conflict of interest because of Mexico.
Are you ready? He's giving me horrible
rulings.
But
I don't care if you criticize him. That's fine. You can criticize every decision. What I'm saying is that not the definition of racism?
No, I don't think so at all.
No?
No. He's proud of his heritage. I respect him for that.
You're saying he can't do his job because of it?
Look, he's proud of his heritage, okay? He's a Mexican. We're building a wall between here and Mexico.
The definition of racism is that someone is, in your opinion, inferior based on their race. In other words, a judge can't make an appropriate, impartial judge decision because he's Mexican. He's an American. He's an American. I got one more. He's an American. He is as an American as Donald Trump is, as you are, as I am. He is an American. Does it get more American than Indiana? It's hard to get more American than Indiana. He is an American, and Trump remains a fool. Racism isn't absolute. Racism doesn't mean you have slaves picking cotton in the backyard. Racism means you see yourself in a position of superiority, and you see someone else in a position of inferiority based on their race. That's exactly what Trump is saying.
You know what else is troubling about that statement, too? He said he's part of a society. That's his heritage.
Well, but it's
that's
not. But the society he's talking about, this is funny. The society he's talking about is a trade organization of lawyers.
Correct.
In the same way Trump is a member of trade organizations of real estate agents and people with orange hair. So the idea that should be some strike against him is ridiculous. The good news is it's not like he went over to CBS and said the same thing about, you know, the possibility of having a Muslim judge.
Would Muslim judge be also out of the question here?
We are allowing tremendous numbers of people coming into this country that we know nothing about. We have a problem in this country. We are going to have big problems. You know, I've been pretty good at predicting things, John. We're going to have big problems. We have people coming into this country totally undocumented. They don't know anything about them. They don't have paperwork. I've interviewed and talked to the best law enforcement people in the business. There's no way of knowing where they come from. And we're taking them in from the so-called migration. They're being sent all over the country. We have people that don't know what they're doing.
My question is, if it were a Muslim judge, would you also feel like they wouldn't be able to treat you fairly because of that policy of yours?
It's possible, yes. Yeah, that would be possible, absolutely.
He's just the best. He is a beauty. And does it strike anyone as uncomfortable, the fact that he's running for president and he's this fired up about one of the, and I'm not making this number up, one of the 3,500 lawsuits that he has filed or had filed against him in the last 25 years? 3,500 lawsuits. And this is his primary talking point from the weekend. It's just remarkable. There was another moment over the weekend, too, where he referred to a black person in his audience as my African-American. That black gentleman has come forward and said, yeah, I don't support Trump.
Yeah, that was awful, too.
He's just the best. Meanwhile, Hillary's got her own problems. Oh, there's the dishonesty thing. There's the foundation thing. There's the email thing. And then there's the book thing. A former Secret Service agent has written a book saying Hillary Clinton was a physical threat to the president of the United States in the 90s. A lot of women who have been victimized by affairs is thinking, yeah, you go, girl. But also, in addition to that, she was incredibly angry, rage-filled, vicious to staff and people who worked at the White House, according to this particular Secret Service agent, who, yes, has a book out. It's 6:30. We'll come back with the big story next on 720 WGN.
I have edema on my thigh, pink stuff in my eye, and I need you now.
Dr. Kevin Most.
I've got a sponsored
by Northwestern Medicine. Impact every day. Are you at the golf course yet?
I am not.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll be going out there shortly.
Okay. Looking forward to seeing you today. Thank you for the invite.
Yeah, we'll have fun. You get to see the boys, and yeah, we'll have a good time.
Each year, the folks at CDH have done this at a level that, frankly, I do a lot of these, and I've never seen them done better. And now with the merger with Northwestern, combining all of those resources. But so people understand, even giant hospitals raise foundational money, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, everybody thinks, oh, we pay so much for hospitalizations. It's covered by insurance. They must have plenty of money to do all the things that they need to do. And in fact, we really don't. So it is nice to have an event like this where we raise awareness for what's going on at the hospital. And we're allowed now to fund some programs that insurance wouldn't cover, which is, you know, in the forefront of what we need to do to make sure that when you're in the hospital, it's the most comfortable time you can be considering the situation.
And there are people that come in all the time who can't afford to pay, and this allows those bills to be taken care of. And then in the middle of the year, let's say Andrea comes in and she's having a bad hair day, mm-hmm. and she needs the special piece of equipment that fixes her hair immediately. Not that this has ever happened to
you. Of course, no.
You know, that might not be in the budget, so you can buy the new piece of equipment. It's that type of thing, right?
Exactly. You know, doctors have wish lists, and unfortunately we can't afford all the things on the wish list, but when you have some foundation dollars, it allows the doctor to go to the foundation and say, hey, this is my idea. It's not in the normal capital process. Is there any way we could fund this year? And, you know, this year we're really going to look at the pediatric life and the patient in the hospital because, you know, kids, they have a tough time. And when they're in the hospital, whether they're there for chemotherapy or an asthma attack or their diabetes, you know, they fall behind in school and it's monotonous in the hospital. So that's what we're going to raise money for today to make sure that those kids, when they're in the hospital, can stay up with their schoolwork and can also, I don't want to say have a good time, but at least put a smile on some of their faces through the day.
And I'll be valet parking out at Medina while you guys play golf and then have a nice dinner. But then Doc comes out and gets me and I come in and do the auction and raise some money. And then he sends me back out to pull people's cars up.
Yeah, put our car up front this time.
And you guys do a great job raising money. If you have not been to an auction with Steve, it's definitely a lot of fun, and he always seems to get into my wallet.
I will vouch for that. I've never seen anyone do an auction quite like you do. You have a very persuasive way of getting people to.
I want your money.
Dave, you got to loan me some money today, by the way.
If I'm showing up for this, and it's a nice cause, this obviously is. If I'm in front of a crowd with a microphone, I want your money. Yeah, that's it. All right, so at 6:45, we'll come back and talk about something that's very seasonal and very specific. Before we do that, the great Muhammad Ali passed away this weekend. His failing health has gone on for 20-plus years. It wasn't shocking news, but certainly sad news. And we're at a point in life, fortunately, where 73 or 4 years old is too young to die. But he lived a long time with Parkinson's. Was he an exception to the rule, or are we getting somewhere with this condition?
Well, we are advancing a little bit. And Parkinson's, everyone probably knows somebody or has seen somebody with Parkinson's, and they have that tremor and they have that shuffling gait and that kind of blank look on their face. And it's because of a chemical in our brain, a neurotransmitter in our brain that just doesn't work well. And the medication that we got, that we use initially, is one called L-DOPA, or dopamine. And that works great for a while, but people build a tolerance to that very quickly. And because of that, the drug really is worthless after a period of time and doesn't actually do anything. So what happens? You have people who have a very sharp mind yet still have this tremor and have the shuffling gait. So what happens is they get socially isolated, and that's just devastating for them. So one of the newer things is something called deep brain stimulation. So it's actually a surgery. We put electrodes into the brain that actually work and take away that tremor. So in some people, it's, you know, it's the game changer. It allows them to continue life. If you haven't seen it, just Google or go on YouTube and do DBS, and you will see the impact it makes. It is unbelievable.
I had an agent with Parkinson's 20 years ago who was just a remarkable man and, you know, had the slow gait and all of that. And you know, he's told this story. I've told this story. But he would get to a point in a negotiation where there'd be a disagreement. And he'd say, well, I hope we can still remain friends. There's no reason not to. He'd get up, shake hands, and it would take him about 30 minutes to get from his chair to the door. By the time he got to the door, the person invariably said, hold on a second, come back.
Yeah.
and he didn't use it. It just happened to be his condition, and he was always very, very amused by it, the fact that this great bump in the road of life turned out to be quite a business move for him. So life is funny that way.
Yeah, and it is a frustrating disease. At Central DuPage, we're lucky. We do more deep brain stimulation surgery than any hospital in the state.
Is that right?
Because we have Dr. Michael Rizak, who's one of the foremost authorities in Parkinson's in the country. So we're pretty fortunate up at CDH.
We'll come back, talk about crash diets for the summer. Everybody wants to look good naked. Stand by for that.
In a bikini.
What?
In a bikini. Not naked. Well, naked too, but...
That's probably just speaking for me. It is 6:52. Dr. Kevin Most, Northwestern Medicine Impact every day. All right, Doc, everybody wants to take their clothes off this time of year, including you. Don't act like you don't. And you want to look good when you do it. So people are doing the crash diet thing, right?
They are. You know, we go through the winter and eat comfort food, and next thing you know, you put on 6, 7, 8, 10 pounds that you didn't want to have on during the summer, and put on those summer clothes that don't fit as well. So it's like, oh my gosh, summer's too short in Chicago. I have to lose all this weight quickly. And we just want to make sure people are going to diet appropriately and do the right things.
Diet appropriately means we have to pick from one of the 427 million choices of which diet to go on, or is it as simple as eat less, move more, and you're going to feel better tomorrow?
Yeah, it's eat smarter, eat the right things, eat the right portions, know what your calories in are, and take advantage of the weather being nice to get out and do some exercise.
Move around.
It is. It is. I'm telling you, it's move around as much as it is intake. But we take in so many calories. I mean, next time you're at McDonald's, just look at what a Big Mac combo meal is. And that's enough calories for the entire day. More than enough for the entire day.
And at these pool parties, too, Doc, there's dips and chips and all kinds of goodies and things like that and alcohol. And you probably shouldn't be drinking as much alcohol anyway in the hot sun.
Correct. And the dips and chip part is very important. People think about, oh, I'm just going to have a couple dips or a couple chips. Well, that increases your thirst. And then you're going to drink another beer. And the cream-based sauces and the dips are terrible. They're loaded with calories. But we eat a lot more of those during the summer than we do in the winter. So it's staying away from those bad foods is probably one of the biggest things.
And it's important to know that no matter how much kale and quinoa you eat, it doesn't counteract all the alcohol you drink on the weekend, Dave.
A doctor?
So Dave, you know, the good thing about the kale is it's great, but be careful with the salad dressing because kale is wonderful and it's a great, mm-hmm. We talked about it. I know you guys give Dave a hard time, but it is, you know, a superfood with high fiber and antioxidants
and it's a great food.
Right, blah, blah, blah. But don't layer on the salad dressing. Be careful with that.
All right, so a lot of this is Eat This, Not That, which is a fairly famous program in a book that was a big hit a few years ago. So you like substitutes for things?
Yeah, I do like substitutes. You know, but obviously right now, fresh vegetables, they're so easy to get. They're so inexpensive. It's not like it's in the winter when we're getting all our fresh vegetables from the Southern Hemisphere. You know, right now, we have plenty of good fresh vegetables. Go to the farmer's market. Get rid of the chips and do carrots. Do green peppers. Do whatever vegetable you really like. And I'm telling you, you're taking in nutrients at that point. You're taking in vitamins, and you're eliminating all those bad fats and a lot of calories right there. Probably one of the biggest things is when you eat breakfast, you know, if you're a big omelet person, go with that egg white omelet because the yolk is where we see all the fat and a lot of the calories. And put vegetables in there instead of cheese. You know, it's just really simple things. You know, we use mustard, use cinnamon, use sugar. If you want something spicy, use cayenne pepper. All of those spices have been shown to increase your metabolism.
What is it about diet soda that's bad? I mean, I know we've heard for years with study after study, the chemical components that make up diet soda are a bad thing. But you keep hearing stuff now in the past few years that diet soda will make you fat. It's not supposed to work that way.
Well, it does. You know, it kind of backfires, right? It says, oh, zero calories. But what happens is when you're having diet soda, what are you having with it? You're having a hamburger. You're having a cheeseburger. And actually, you're using the diet soda. This is a study I've shown. You're using the diet soda to justify what you're eating. Oh, I'm not having those calories there, therefore I can eat this. And that goes that just backfires. And almost every study has shown that people that drink diet soda are still going to put on weight. That is not a weight loss idea.
How about the vitamin waters and the Gatorades and the Powerades, too? Because we drink a lot of that on the golf course, too.
Yep. Yep. And if you look at those, some of those have calories. But again, if you're using it at the right time, they're good for you.
You know, like a G2 water rotation, right?
Absolutely. That's what I do, is flip-flop them back and forth. So you're not going to get a whole ton of calories, but you are going to get some of the nutrients, and you're going to get some of the chemicals that you need. So, you know, keeping that sodium, we get enough sodium in our diet, but keeping some of those salts in when we're out exercising, the Gatorade will do that. It'll give you a little bit of energy as well. But really the goal when you're outside is to stay hydrated, so it's more important that you're drinking a lot of water at that time as well.
All right, I don't like talking about this during the breakfast hour, but are the cleanses important?
You know, people do cleanses and they think that they make them feel better and they think that they lose weight. A lot of it's psychological. What a cleanse is anybody who's had a colonoscopy has done a prep for the colonoscopy, and that's essentially what the cleanse is.
Good times.
In the summer, we're very concerned about people doing it because you have a tendency to get dehydrated when you have the prep for the colonoscopy. Well, think about coupling that now with a 90-degree day. So you've already lost a lot of fluid. You're already behind, and now you go outside. So until you get that fluid back so that to a point where you're not dehydrated, we want people to be very careful. So I'm not a big fan of cleanses. You know, if you have a colonoscopy, great. You need to do it for the prep. But besides that, does not add a lot of value in my mind.
And once and for all, how much water for a grown man and a grown woman every day?
You know, we talked about this. It's kind of one of those fallacies. We used to say 6 to 8 ounces, you know, 5, 6, 7 glasses of those a day. And really, if you do 4 of those a day, you're getting plenty of other water through your food. So when they did the study, they came up with this is how much water you need. But they didn't realize that you're getting that in some of your meats, you're getting that in some of your vegetables. So now we've blown that number out of proportion, and really it can come down much lower. So, you know, 4 or 5 8-ounce glasses of water a day is perfect.
And eat after a workout, right? I mean, once you're really active, eat after a workout because your metabolism is fired up?
Well, yeah, because, you know, it's not a bad idea. So, you know, if you are going to work out and you're a big workout person, eat after you've worked out. So, you know, and but really the one of the biggest things is just limit your calories. Look, keep track of your calories. 1,200 to 1,500 calories in a day is exactly what you're going to need.
All right, it's Dr. Kevin Most. We'll see you in a little bit. Hold the line if you would, Doc, and thank you as always.
You got it.
And it's Northwestern Medicine, impact every day.
Back to the Steve Cochran Show.
I'm going to float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. George can't hit what his hands can't see. Now you see me, now you don't. He think he will, but I know he won't. They tell me George is good, but I'm twice as nice. And I'm going to stick to his butt like white on rice.
That's right.
That's the greatest of all time.
He's rhyming before it was cool. The goat and the poet. Greatest of all time and a P-O-E-T. Muhammad Ali dies this weekend. And appropriately, around the world, people have stepped up to talk about their feelings on the champ, the greatest of all time. And joining us on the phone is Bill Siegel. Bill did Hoop Dreams. And there's no better sports researcher, period. I mean, anywhere. And his movie, The Trials of Muhammad Ali, is not about the boxing. It's about the trials of life outside of the ring. Good morning, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing well. Just got to jump in and clarify. I didn't do Hoop Dreams. I was a researcher out there, but that's Steve James. I did partner with Kurt Templin on The Trials of Muhammad Ali, and honored to do so, and honored to be on here. Thank you for having me.
Well, I appreciate the clarification, but you were certainly a big part of it. I know that. So The Trials of Muhammad Ali, in doing this film, and then you hear about him passing this weekend, your perspective may be a little different than ours. What hits you first?
Grief and sadness, which I think is being shared everywhere around the world, as well, hopefully, as some celebration and inspiration. You know, it's such a mixture of overwhelmment. I mean, he's the greatest. We lost a huge, towering figure, and you know, I'm so blessed to have been graced with his presence, personally and professionally. And at this point, want to do what I can to help keep his spirit alive, which it is, and I believe forever will be. And to me, a big part of that is hoping that in that mixture of emotions that people are honestly and understandably feeling, that inspiration piece will really come through. Because I don't think we'll ever see another Muhammad Ali in the ring, but I honestly believe his capacity to lead a truly moral, principled, fearless, loving life is a capacity that exists within all of us. And he's a guiding light, will always be for me in that regard. And I hope for people in the world as well, because he's a mighty force to reckon with.
Very well said by you. And since this is not a boxing film, but a film about life, some of the people you sat down and talked with are some of the people that knew him better than all of us, but including his brother. And it struck me how many people didn't even realize he had a brother. What can you share with us that comes up in the film in regards to the thoughts of his brother?
Yeah, I mean, Rahman is pure love. And he lives in Louisville, and I haven't been able to get a hold of him since Muhammad died, and I've been trying, and I'm sure I will. But he was there for everything. You know, if you watch the film and you look in the background, he's there. He's on camera almost as much in the archival footage as Muhammad. He was, you know, right alongside his brother through that whole journey. And there's a scene in the film where Rahman is speaking to, you know, the moment when Ali is convicted of draft evasion and sentenced to 5 years in prison and banned from boxing and really at the bottom. You know, it's easy. History, I think, sometimes makes it easy for us to look back and understand Ali as being right from hindsight's perspective. But in the moment, when you're on that doorstep of history, as he was, looking forward and ready to sacrifice everything as he did, Rahman, in describing what that was like, breaks down and cries. And it's a very emotional moment in the film. And moreover, I know in his life that was the case.
The arc of his character is pretty remarkable, in that he is certainly one of the most famous people that ever lived. But when I was a little kid, when he didn't accept the induction into the draft for Vietnam, or into the service for Vietnam, I remember grown-ups all around me talking about him being a traitor and a coward and all sorts of horrible things. You fast forward through his life, through the illness, and a real seminal moment for me was 1996, when he was the surprise celebrity that that lights a flame in Atlanta at his most physically vulnerable. He had the courage to stand up and do that, and there wasn't a dry eye in America. I mean, I get choked up just thinking about it now. Has there ever been an arc like that?
I don't know, but I mean, not to my heart. Ali's is unique in that regard. And that moment in Atlanta lighting the torch, you know, I think some of those people that you're talking about, maybe they think about it in the sense of forgiving Ali, but I think of it as in the sense of him forgiving us. Hmm. You know, because he in his own way stood for his country. I heard a guy say this on the NBA Finals last night, one of the broadcasters, that Ali stood for his country when his country let him down. And he was there representing the world, really, at that moment in Atlanta. And, I mean, he's come out in so many inspiring ways. Another one for me that is captured momentarily in the film that will always stay with me, that I think people often overlook or forget, or maybe never even knew, but 10 days after the World Trade Center collapsed in that horrible terrorist attack,
right,
Ali is on national TV reminding people, shaking with Parkinson, saying Islam means peace.
Right.
And that was an incredibly courageous moment as well.
A devoted Muslim from the time of his name change and beyond. It was not a publicity stunt, and it was an excuse to avoid the war. Andres, add a bill.
Bill, what I also thought was amazing, too, about Ali was how he was such a goodwill ambassador, an overseas ambassador, if you will. In 91, I think a lot of people forgot he was in Iraq helping to negotiate for the hostage return. And then I think he was in Afghanistan in 2002 as well. So he did a lot of overseas goodwill work, too.
Absolutely. I can't. I mean, I think that those kinds of things and so many others are why people call him the people's champion. You know, of course, it's partly because of his feats in the ring, but it's also because of his work like that as a really a goodwill humanitarian ambassador all over the world. And in doing that, you know, I honestly believe that as much love as there is in the world for Muhammad Ali, he matched that for the world. He loved people. That was his thing. He loved being out in the world with people in every way.
Bill, when was your last conversation with him? When did you see him last?
I last saw him in October of 2012. I had a fine cut of the film that I wanted to show him and his wife, Lonnie, before it went out in the world. And that was a personal and professional thrill and honor that will forever stay with me. And I sat on the couch in the living room in Scottsdale, Arizona, in between Lonnie and Muhammad, and basically watched Muhammad watch the film that I had made. And I can definitely say he dug the film, but that's a very easy thing for me to say because I also know that Muhammad Ali loved nothing more than to watch stuff about Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, well, you know what? Part of the charm, right?
Right, in a certain sense, he was the absolute easiest audience member to please. There he was.
Look how pretty I was.
Right.
Cardam Quinn.
Entirely. You know, watching him watch the film, it was clear that he knew exactly what he was watching, what he was seeing. You know, Malcolm X came on the screen, and Ali just bowed. He couldn't really watch that moment in sorrow. And Khalilah, his wife at the time, with the film documents, comes on, and Ali just lights up, you know, just the sun on his face. It was an amazing experience.
Is it Kartemkin or Cardam Quinn, the company?
Kartemkin.
Kartemkin.
It's a combination of the three founders' names, and they're in their 50th anniversary year, and I co-produced the film with them, and they were just incredible help. We made it together, and they're celebrating their 50th anniversary all summer. There's a exhibit in Chicago at the Cultural Center. There's a big event coming up at the Harris Center on June 24th. I encourage people to check out Kartemkin's amazing work.
And it's Kartemquin. You can order the DVD there or download it on iTunes or Netflix or Amazon or Google Play and other sources as well. Again, kartemquin.com. Bill, it's a pleasure to speak with you. Nice work.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
All the best. The Trials of Muhammad Ali. Chet Kopic on Ali. Later in the hour as well. Got tickets to see Kristen Chenoweth in concert.
That's a treat. She's wonderful.
You ever met her?
I've not met her.
She's about 18 inches tall. She can fit in my pocket.
Yeah, she's tiny. I've seen her perform, but she's wonderful.
I don't know how she sings with that voice.
So good.
Comes from the bottom of her feet, man. She sings her whole body off. You know, some people can sing their butt off. She sings her whole body off.
She does.
So anyway, we'll tell you I can win those coming up here in just a second. On Friday, when the death of... Was it Friday night when Ali's death was announced? Vin Scully, arguably the greatest baseball voice of all time, was on the air doing the Dodgers game. Here's a clip.
We have just received distressing news, although there were a lot of people figuring that we were coming close to the end. The story out of Arizona, we understand right now that Muhammad Ali, the former Cassius Clay, has passed away. That, of course, will be a huge story throughout the sports world, affecting not only boxing fans, fans of every sport, and those who don't care about sports. He had so much of a reaction from his fans and the impression that he made on so many people. Muhammad Ali. What was it? Move like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Something like that. Float like a butterfly. Okay. Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee.
Vin Scully. Somehow when Vin says it, it's just better. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. So, Dave, you and I grew up. You're a little older than I am. Not much older.
Thank
you're a little
you.
Older than I am, but you and I grew up in the Ali era.
Sure.
and just little kids when he was banned from boxing for 3 years. He comes back to that huge fight with Joe Frazier at Madison Square Garden, mm-hmm. which he loses in 15 rounds.
Mm-hmm.
And then comes back in two more epic fights with Frazier. And then the George Foreman thriller in Manila and the rope-a-dope, where George Foreman for years has said, in the rope-a-dope, I'm the dope. And Foreman talked a lot this weekend about the fact that he became, or Ali became his best friend. After pounding on each other for that fight, Ali became his best friend, which says something about their relationship as well.
Yes.
But my experience, I never met him. Never met him, never spoke to him, did you?
I don't remember. I know I had some contact, covered something. I don't remember one-on-one okay. talking to Muhammad
yeah.
Ali.
He's one of the people I'd always hoped to meet, and I just mm-hmm. never had the opportunity. But the thing that struck me as a little kid was, wow, you know, he's loud. He's really loud, and maybe he shouldn't be bragging like that. And then you get a little older, you get a little perspective, and you're always amazed at the athletic talent. But I was always amused by he and Cosell, because he and Cosell were a part of Wide World of Sports.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime they could put those two on, that was reality TV before there was any.
No question.
And then he got late in his career, and he had a couple of bad fights. I think he ended up 56-5 overall. But the way he handled himself with class and dignity after he got sick was really remarkable. And I keep coming back to that night in Atlanta, and you and I were just talking off the air about this. You asked 100 people what they remember about the Atlanta Games. It would be the bombing and Ali.
Right, right.
And I don't know if they remember anything else. Maybe the gymnast.
Kerry Strug.
Kerry Strug.
Yeah, but that was it.
That's it.
I mean, that was the most anticipated event going into the Olympics
right.
was lighting the Olympic cauldron by Muhammad Ali.
And the thing that struck me about it was, because it was not a well-kept secret, but it was a secret. The thing that struck me about it was he was in full symptomatic, you know, he was in the throes of his troubles there. And to have a guy who made his life and his career on being a physical specimen, that was his calling card, that's who he was,
mm-hmm.
and that's what made him so great, to put himself in front of everyone on the planet and to be that vulnerable was unbelievably gutsy. And there's a story that goes along with it. He was actually burned by the flame as he tried to light it. He was having trouble holding the flame. And the flame shot up the whatever the thing is called, where the flame is held.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't know that.
The club, whatever it is.
Where the torch. The torch part.
Yeah, the torch part. And burned his hand. But he was able to hold on to it and light the flame and start the games. But just to go from who he was in the 60s to who he was then, and even take on that, to take it on physically, and again, to put himself out there the way he did, I think it was an inspiration to anybody that's sick
mm-hmm.
to don't back down from challenges, but also was just an incredibly moving moment. And as I said to Bill a little while ago, you know, the guy goes from being really reviled in a large part of America in the 60s for walking away from the draft to being a real visionary about what the Vietnam War was and what it wasn't, and for taking a stand based on his faith, which he had every right to do.
And he endured, obviously, not only the financial losses and the loss of a chunk of his career.
Prime time. But 3 years of prime career.
You have to remember, I've been watching this LBJ film. I've watched it twice now on HBO
phenomenal.
With Bryan Cranston.
Yeah.
And it
called All the Way.
All the Way. And it drives home what the racial climate was in this country in the 60s.
Right.
And Muhammad Ali was right in the middle of that and on the receiving end of so much vitriol and hatred. Clearly, today, people appreciate what he did and the stand he took. But it was a different man. I can't imagine some of the stuff he had to endure.
Yeah, and only in America. Mm-hmm. Only in America do you get to have that kind of a comeback story.
Yeah.
And that kind of longevity. Muhammad Ali, more from Chet Coppock coming up. Chet knew him, of course. We'll get to Chet here in a little bit. Right after we get to the big story on 720 WGN.
This is the Steve Cochran Show.
I sat back there and I listened to every word you said. Howard, every time you open your mouth, you should be arrested for air pollution. More trouble. You give me more trouble than my opponents. Now, like, I heard you were going to host a show, so I thought I would give you the honor of coming to talk with you. Now, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk with you, first of all, about the fact that you would still be in impoverished anonymity in this country if I hadn't made you famous.
Now listen.
Telling you, Cosell and Ali.
The best.
It was something else. 743. If there's a walking, talking sports historian and librarian in this country, let alone in the city of Chicago, it's Chet Kopic. Let's go to the library now. Good morning, Chester.
Hey, Champ. How are you, Steve?
I'm doing fine. What hit you when you heard Ali was gone?
Great sense of loss. An end of an era. Maybe a little loss of innocence. You know, Steve, when the Beatles invited Sullivan back in 64, that's the same year that a young Cassius Marcellus Clay stopped Sonny Liston to win the heavyweight title. I had the good fortune to interview Muhammad three or four times over the years. And one quick anecdote that I think you'll get a kick out of. In 1973, I went to the London House to see Chubby Checker, you know, do the twist. I was only 13 years behind the times. But about halfway through the set, completely unannounced, who walks in and begins doing the twist and out-twisting Chubby Checker but Muhammad Ali?
Oh, there was a crowd, baby. Had to be there.
That's the happy side. See, the sad side for me is, yeah, I think back to the third fight with Joe Frazier, which Muhammad described as the closest thing to death. I think back to him getting knocked down by Smoking Joe, March 8th of 71 in the Garden. I think about Ken Norton breaking his jaw. I think about the heinous beating given to him by Larry Holmes, and I think we all have to take a step back and realize that Muhammad, as much as he perhaps did suffer from Parkinson's, basically was punchy. He just got hit too many times. He frequently trained without any type of headgear. There was an aura of invincibility about him. There was a very loving quality about him. We've lost, Steve, as you well know. I'm going to have to tell you this, but we've lost a man who for two decades, perhaps three decades, was the best-known man in the world.
Yep. The most famous athlete in the world, the most famous face in the world. And it really came around because, kids, you got to remember, way before the internet here, but when he went to Africa to fight Foreman, there's great film footage of this about the people of Africa in remote villages coming out to line dirt, mud-stained roads just to chant Ali's name. When you go, well, how do they even know he's in country? He was absolutely the most famous face in the world.
Chad, a lot of it, I think you alluded to the fact that he was hit a lot. And there was, in boxing back then, I mean, that was sort of the ability to take a punch carried a lot of weight, didn't it? I mean, we didn't know what we know today.
We didn't. Also, you know, it was a different time, Steve, and this may sound abstract, but for referees, it was a much different time. For example, if you go on YouTube and type in Emil Griffith against Benny Kid Perrette, you'll see Kid Perrette absorbed 21 unanswered blows from Emil. He died. What transpired, the referee, who was a gentleman named Ruby Goldstein, very simply froze. I talked about the fight in Las Vegas with Larry Holmes in 1980. 10 wicked, vicious rounds in which Muhammad did nothing but absorb punches. You know, people at ringside were chanting, stop the fight. And I've always believed that the Ali corner, Angelo Dundee, wanted to stop the fight, but the black Muslims would not let him do so. And mind you, that as much effect as Angelo had on the career of Muhammad, the black Muslims were always in charge of what was transpiring with Ali. For example, when Ali refuses induction and he's no longer a breadwinner, a moneymaker for the black Muslims, who is the first guy who rejects him but Elijah Muhammad?
Yeah, well, he had a great break, right, from Malcolm X for that and for the reason of violence, because he did not believe the religion should encompass violence, and that was one of the great sadnesses as he went through the latter stages of his life, I think, as well. What about the giving side of Ali? What did you know of that, his charitable side? Because we've heard an awful lot about that this weekend.
You know, Steve, a remarkable ability to make people laugh, whether they were 5, 15, or 75. Desire to educate people about Parkinson's disease, his willingness to go out in public with the afflictions that he suffered and let people see what had transpired with him. He was a remarkable man of courage. Did he have a big ego? Of course he did. I mean, you can't be Muhammad Ali without a very, very big ego. And sure. By the way, much of his comedy material came from the mind of a man who admitted he wasn't the brightest guy in the world. But he did have this, he had this poetic ability. And, you know, think about it in these terms, Steve. How do you not link at all times Muhammad Ali with Howard Cosell? For example, you know, Howard saying to Ali, "Well, it appears, Muhammad, that you're feeling very truculent." And Ali responds by saying, "Well, if that means good, you're right."
right. But I'm telling you, those wide world moments that we remember were unbelievable.
They were great. But, Chet, it didn't start out as a stand-up comedy bit with the two of them. I mean, Howard was a serious journalist starting out interviewing Ali. And along the way, I mean, they had their differences. But ultimately, I think they realized, didn't they, that they were each other's best friend in terms of what they could do for the other guy.
Steve, I believe they were like Lewis and Martin. You know, obviously Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin were not the best of friends, but they recognized that as a tandem, they could make a great deal of money, and they were very, very good and remarkably entertaining. I think the same thing might have been true to a degree with Cosell, although I do know this. I had the good fortune to emcee a couple of events with Howard back in the 1990s, and Howard's reverence for Muhammad Ali would almost move you to tears. And it broke my heart over the last 15, 20 years to see Muhammad in this weakened condition, because he was the man with the Ali shuffle. He was the man with the greatest left jab in the history of boxing. Here is a man who was such a brutal underdog that on the day he beat Liston in March of 1964, the physician who examined him the day of the fight said, and I quote, "He's scared."
Right. And that's my diagnosis.
Think about how big Muhammad Ali was without the benefit of social media.
Right.
If Ali fought today, I mean, Steve, ask yourself this question. When was the last time you went out of your way to watch a heavyweight fight?
Yeah, nobody. Nobody.
In 15 years.
No, well, I got to tell you, I believe great boxing died with Ali's career. I mean, even through the 80s and Tyson.
Absolutely.
You know,
Don
Absolutely. King made it dirty. Aram made it dirty. And it just, you know, now it's just an afterthought. But there's really no way, Chet, and Dave, and you guys know this, to describe how big a deal a heavyweight bout was prior to 1980 and really prior to 1975. It was a stop the country moment.
Yeah. And
well,
remember,
Dave, Dave.
Yeah, it wasn't live either. Remember that?
That's true.
And pay-per-view, Chet, pay-per-view isn't what it is today. I mean, you had to go to where, the amphitheater, or go to a theater to watch those fights?
Steve, I had to go to the Aragon Ballroom, and the visuals were so bad, you weren't sure if you were watching Muhammad Ali or a Japanese film with subtitles. But it was Ali, and Dave, you know this as well as anybody does. Muhammad Ali didn't have fights. He had events.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. When Muhammad fought, it was an event. It galvanized people. I mean, there were people who vilified him. There were people who were in love with him. There was no middle ground with Cassius Marcellus Clay, this young man from Louisville who began to fight because he was going to whoop some boy who stole his bike. And, you know, Steve, one thing that has not been touched upon because of the political realm, but I think it has to be mentioned in this. You know, regarding Vietnam, regarding his refusal to accept induction, and I believe that, yes, he was sincere in his religious beliefs. I have never forgotten this statement from Ali. "No Viet Cong ever called me N-word."
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
That has stuck with me for 40 years.
Yeah. He didn't. I don't have a war with them. I'm not going to go over and kill them. Chet, great perspective as always. Nothing but the best, buddy. I appreciate you taking some time.
Hey, my good friend, listen, it's Cochran putting for Eagle here on 14.
Well, that's the kind of call I usually pay for. At Chet Kopic, at C-H-E-T-C-O-P-P-O-C-K, at Chet Kopic. There's another quote attributed to Ali this weekend, which I had not heard, but which I loved. And it said, the service you give to others on earth is the rent you pay for your room in heaven. How great is
that's
that?
That's nice.
Yeah. He's tremendous. It's 7:58. You got a little music for me? A little Kristen Chenoweth? Give me a little Kristen Chenoweth.
Somewhere over the rainbow.
No, that's Dave. Give me Kristen Chenoweth. That was Dave singing. You want to hear it again?
Yes.
All right, let me hear it again.
Somewhere over the rainbow.
I mean, that comes out of like a 4-foot, 9-inch package.
She's telling you, her voice is crazy awesome.
Emmy Tony Award winning Kristen Chenoweth performing with members of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra for one night only, Monday, June 20th. She'll sing all of the iconic songs you love her for. It's a fundraiser for the CFO with proceeds helping to support nationally acclaimed community engagement programs. Here's what we'll do. Every day this week, we'll qualify somebody. We'll give you a copy of her last disc that you can play in your car and sing like she sings. At least you'll think you're singing that way. And at the end of the week, we'll give away tickets. The CD is called Coming Home. I think it was from 2014 or 15.
Yeah, she was the original Wicked with Idina Menzel.
Yeah.
Or Adele Dazeem, depending on what you call her these days.
So you'll win the CD, and you'll qualify for the tickets. So I'll give you a clue. When you hear Kristen Chenoweth sing, you call in to win at 312-981-7200. And since we're off at 9, it will happen in the next hour. You have to hear this. That's it.
That's a clue.
At some point between now and 9 o'clock, you'll hear this. That's it. All right. So when you hear that.
It's like a name. What is it? Like a name that tune in one note kind of a thing?
Yeah, we're short on time.
It all sounds right, like Kate Smith and God Bless America.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Dean Richards joins us from Channel 9.
Citizens of the world.
Some of the world's greatest entertainers are here tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I present to you.
And tonight, guess what? It's going to be Dean.
Yeah, Hollywood. You know I love you more than what I should. Yeah, Hollywood. Well, kiss me, kiss me good.
8:12, Dean Richards here. Hi, buddy. Yeah, me too. It's a wrong button. Sorry. That was my fault.
Have a nice day.
Hi, Dean. How are you?
And like I was saying, and then the house burned down. What?
Crazy. Coming up, Richard Simmons is in the hospital, or is he? Taylor Swift is crashing a wedding, or isn't she? Kanye West is starting riots. There's a new Transformers movie and a couple of pieces on Muhammad Ali.
Wow. This report sounds a lot more interesting than I had planned it.
It's because I'm a professional teaser. Look at you tease.
There's a lot of pressure to make this good.
How was your weekend?
It was really good. I didn't really do anything overly exciting. But
I was listening to the show yesterday. You had one of your cute little clown friends on. Who was on yesterday?
My clown friends?
Yeah, you had one of your cute little clown friends on yesterday. Was that a taped interview, that your playback?
I don't remember any clowns on the show yesterday.
You were talking about Bozo.
Outside of myself.
You were talking about Bozo and Wizzo and Zippo and Skippy and Zippy.
Are you sure you were listening to WGN?
Was it the best of Eric and Kathy? Could have been.
I don't believe.
Did you do the show yesterday?
I did do the show.
Of course
yesterday.
You did, because I heard you. You were talking about the clowns.
I don't remember.
Send in the clowns.
I think you may have been hallucinating.
Too much sun?
I had a fantastic hour-long interview with the legendary Phil. Oh, well, you know what? We had a great interview with Phil Donahue, and he spent many of his years doing his national talk show from here at WGN-TV.
Yeah.
And we spoke very briefly about Bozo because he was friends with Bob Bell. But that's what you got out of my Phil Donahue interview, that I talked to the clowns?
Were you talking to him about going out to dinner with the Bell family?
He had.
No, you were. You said something about I occasionally have a chance to
I mentioned that
we have dinner with the Bell family.
I did mention that. Yes.
Was that Phil? I'll be honest with you. I didn't know who you were talking about.
I was talking to Phil Donahue.
I would have listened to the whole interview. Then.
It's on the web.
Well, I'll pick it up.
Really interesting interview. I don't know if you have an hour to spare in your life. I know you're very busy.
Incredibly busy. You know, I'm leaving at 9 today to go play golf.
But
that's work.
We talked with Phil. You know, he was pretty close friends with Muhammad Ali. Appeared with him many times. So you know, mostly we talked about that. But
how is Phil?
He's doing pretty well. He just turned 80 years old.
Is that right?
He's still, you know, he's a little bit slower, as I imagine we all would be when we turn 80 years old.
I'm slower at 55.
But still very, very sharp, very articulate. I think he's great. I'm a huge fan.
Me too.
Of his.
Love him. Does he bug Marlo when he does the fake talk show in the living room?
He does. He wakes up in the morning, you know, goes into the kitchen to get some coffee, and he goes, "Is the caller there?" That's a little weird.
And then whenever she asks a question, he takes the microphone, puts one knee up on a chair, and drops his head.
Yeah.
You know the Phil move, the Donahue move?
I'm going to go get the mail. We'll be right back. That's weird in a relationship. But he's doing great. He told some stories about Muhammad Ali that you, Mr. Big Softy, will get a tear in your eye, guaranteed, when you listen to it.
Oh, well, good. Well, I will.
Really sweet stories. But because he spent so many years here at WGN, he knew Bob Bell, the original Bozo. I had mentioned to him.
I just knew you'd work Bozo into it somehow.
That the Bell family was they were at the Walk of Fame ceremony.
Yeah,
I mentioned
yeah.
that we got together. That I'm friends with Bob Bell's family, So
was it Bob Bell's grandkids who were there? Who?
No, his son. His
son.
His son.
Son. Because that kid, huge shoes.
His son Jeff and his daughter-in-law Cindy were nice enough to come down for the Walk of Fame.
Yeah, that was very nice.
They did the breast cancer walk over the weekend.
Again,
they
in huge shoes.
That. It's not easy to do. It's not easy to walk that far
right.
in a clown suit and giant shoes.
Did Bozo get along with Ronald McDonald?
I think they did.
Did they ever have like a clown summit?
I don't believe there was ever any fist fight or throwdown, clown throwdown, anything through the years.
Be a good title for a hip hop album.
Steve, the clown world, by its very nature, is fun and happy.
Yes, it's very true. Did you know Bob Collins was afraid of clowns?
I did know that, yes.
Yeah, and did you know David Kaplan is afraid of clowns?
Didn't know that.
Oh, deathly. We got, me. Someone got him a clown surprise for his birthday, Dean, and he walked in, and I've never seen Dave Kaplan jump so high. Or move so quickly.
Except when he gets more free swag from a university nearby.
Hey, big boy. The next time that Bozo is around, which will be the Pride Parade, he appears on the TV float. Well, let's see if we can get him to swing by Kaplan's.
Oh, that'd be tremendous. Because I really like Bozo.
Bozo's a good guy.
Yeah, Bozo's the best.
Bozo's a good guy.
What's
wrong with you today?
What are you talking about?
You're giddy. You're
not fun. Totally fun. Got a lot of sun this weekend.
Did you get a lot of rest this weekend?
No, I did not. I didn't get a lot of rest, but as a matter of fact, I woke up at 2 today, which is about 6 hours later than I normally wake up, or earlier, I should say.
Yep.
I was out and I played golf. Out in the sun all weekend.
Seem super giddy. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm enjoying it.
No, I think you're saying it's bad.
But, you know, usually you don't, you know, usually I got to sort of carry it through this segment a little bit.
Dean, he's
I
worried.
I did not know that.
He's worried.
Dean just said, Dean's back is killing him.
I have to put Steve on my back for 20 minutes.
It's unbelievable.
Dean, he's worried because he has to leave a little early today.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the only.
That's very troublesome.
You're nervous.
Yeah, I hate leaving the show in anyone's hands.
Are you leaving early to go play golf?
Yep, that's what I'm doing.
I got to get a contract like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Not that I golf, but.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, most days I work 4 hours. So, you know, occasionally a girl needs a break.
You can travel Chicago. You'll be calling his name. Oh, 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 oh. Dean Richard, the entertainment editor.
Channel 823, Richard Simmons has been kind of out of the public spotlight for a couple of years now. And every time he was in Chicago, he'd always come by. I considered him a show business friend, Dean, and then he sort of disappeared.
In the very studio where you're sitting right now, he once jumped on my chest like a little chimpanzee.
Yeah, he came into another place I was thrown out of and gave me an awkward hug and... Well, the therapy's going fine. That's all.
Well, that's one step at a time.
That's it.
He there have been rumors that he was being held, not being allowed to go in public. That his caretaker, his housekeeper, Wasn't letting him go out in public. But he reassured fans that he's fine. He was hospitalized on Friday night with dehydration. That caretaker, longtime friend, called 911, said that he was exhibiting what was described as bizarre behavior and had become incoherent. But
listen, I love Richard like you love Richard. How could you tell the difference?
Right.
That's exhibiting right. bizarre behavior. That's what he does.
Is it like bizarre behavior for most of us?
Right.
Or bizarre behavior for Richard? He went to the hospital, was dehydrated, needed fluids. He's fine. Issued a statement thanking all of his fans, says he's feeling great, and offered this tip, Steve, in the summertime, you're going to be out on the golf course today. Drink plenty of liquids.
Very important.
Drink
very
plenty of important. Liquids. Says Richard Simmons.
Well, we hope he's okay. That's all.
Seems to be.
Okay. Taylor Swift has got plenty to do. I mean, she's busy breaking up with dudes left and right.
Oh, according to the reports, she got broken up with this time.
Oh, Calvin Harris dumped her?
Yeah, that's what the reports are saying.
By the way, I know who Calvin Harris is.
Who found out?
He's a famous disc jockey.
He is a, well, DJ.
Yeah.
DJ.
Yeah.
Disc jockey is like us, playing Barry Manilow records in the 70s.
I thought he did Afternoons at the Mix.
DJ. DJs. I thought he was Delilah all this time.
Delilah. There's that name I haven't heard in a while. So she shows up where?
She's got all this time on her hands now. She crashed a wedding over the weekend. She went to the wedding of Max Singer and Kenya Smith in New Jersey over the weekend. She was invited. The groom's sister wrote a letter to her. Saying that the couple got legally married at a hospital sometime before the actual ceremony, the formal wedding, so their mother could witness it before her death, wrote that letter to Taylor Swift. Taylor Swift, who famously goes and visits kids who are dealing with one illness or another, shows up at this wedding unannounced, shows up, sits down at the piano, sings her song Blank Space for the couple to do their dance, and posed for pictures with everybody, and even showed up with a gift, a hand-painted card as a wedding gift. I would have preferred a salad shooter myself. Yeah, but
she cheaped out.
Yeah, yep. I don't know how she does it. I don't know how she does all these drop-ins.
She does it all the time.
Yeah.
Does it all the time.
I think she deserves credit, man. You know, it's tough if you don't have anybody to filter those, because how do you say no to anybody? But good for her.
I give her a lot of credit. Meanwhile, Calvin Harris started performing again over the weekend.
You mean the famous disc jockey?
He was out of commission for a couple of weeks because he was in a pretty bad car crash, but did a couple of shows in Las Vegas over the weekend.
Taylor Swift cut the bricks.
And just to show his sadness over this breakup, went out for a wild night out with the boys in Vegas on Saturday night.
We had a great time. Yeah, Calvin Harris and me and the other guys.
I say you're a DJ. You're Delilah. You're really Delilah, aren't you?
I heard Calvin Harris was out with the other DJs. I thought I was invited.
It's a DJ party. That's the last party I would ever go to.
Oh, no kidding. No kidding.
Hey man! Did you hear that? Did you hear my intro to Barry Manilow?
Any business that would employ a human being named Man Cow probably isn't a great business. Kanye West is in New York, and he decides to have a secret little concert. Well, it's not a secret, and he nearly caused a riot.
It's exactly what happened. He was supposed to appear at this governor's ball that was to take place, an outdoor event that got rained out. So he tweets out that he's going to do a pop-up concert at 2 o'clock in the morning. He never actually went on the stage. Instead, got in an SUV, drove around the area waving to fans. People were not so happy about that. And cars were vandalized. There was a little mayhem that went on. Fans on social media are trashing Kanye West. I'm sure he hasn't been able to sleep since all that went on. He cares about others very much.
Very much. He's always about other people. There is a new Transformers movie coming to be made. Is it going to be made here again? Because it made a mess when it was here before.
They were shooting right outside of the Allstate Showcase studio window. I remember doing my show and watching taxi cabs fly by the window and explosions while they did that. We haven't heard if they're going to shoot in Chicago this time. I know that Michael Bay wants to. The director wants to. He told me that. Of all people, Mark Wahlberg is going to be in the movie. Josh Duhamel is going to be in the movie. Comedian Jared Carmichael is going to be part of the cast this time. But of all people, Oscar winner Anthony Hopkins is going to be in Transformers.
Somebody 5. Needs a paycheck.
One of these things is not like the other.
Somebody needs a paycheck. All right, and finally, a couple of pieces of sound on Ali. What do you have?
We have, first of all, Ali on Johnny Carson, several appearances that he made. So witty, so funny. I mean, this, you know, we're hearing about his sports prowess and his social activism, but when he would appear on these talk shows, he was great, and here's a bunch of visits all combined together on Johnny Carson.
You're getting old.
That makes two of us.
I'd rather be with you than all the rest, because you don't ask me no tough questions. You're real nice. You know, you own most of the shows your own deals. You're real tricky, you know, but you're really a nice fella. You don't ask nobody nothing controversial, nothing to stir up nobody. You happy and go, you know.
But would you like me to ask you some tough questions? I mean, does that bother you when people ask you?
Well, you try it and you see.
I had about 9 fights in the Navy.
Is that right? Well, you must have been pretty good, because I don't see no marks on you or nothing.
Well, I don't see many marks on you either.
Well, I am pretty good.
Yeah. Now, we've known each other. You've been on the show. The first time, I think, was 8 or 9 years ago, something like that.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Your hair was black then.
My hair was.
You just looked so nice on television, and this piece is real thin, and the wrinkles weren't there, and your hair was black, and Johnny Carson. Now you look like a woman.
Loved it. Mom and Ali had that on. You know, when he was on with Phil Donahue, you know, we talked about this yesterday, this playfulness that he had when he was on the shows. One other clip that we have is not Ali, but it's actually the legendary comedian George Carlin. You want to hear a piece of classic comedy. This is from 1971, Carlin talking about Muhammad Ali.
The big fight is coming up. Ali and Frazier, Muhammad Ali. I call him Muhammad Ali because that's what he wants. Oh, yeah, he's a big dude and he hits hard, you know. I'll call him what he wants. But it's good that he's being allowed to work again. As you know, he couldn't work for 3 years. Of course, he had a strange job beating people up. But that was his right. He could have that job. Government wanted him to change jobs. Government wanted him to kill people. He thought it over and he said, no, that's where I draw the line. I'll beat him up, but I don't want to kill him. And the government told him, well, if you won't kill him, we won't let you beat him up.
Great joke. That's a great joke.
Such good comedy from George Carlin.
Yeah, it's a great joke. All right, buddy. Talk to you later.
Bye.
That's Dean Richards back with a big story next on 720 WGN.
This is the Steve Cochran Show.
The enemy wanted him to come out all blasted. But my Lord, myself said no, though.
Yeah. Well, I know God. I know
Cassius.
The real God.
Cassius, wait a minute, Cassius.
Hold you on. Must listen to me.
We could not foresee the difficulties that would lie ahead as far as military service and, of course, the Muslim affiliation.
You won't fight for your country. You refuse to go into the...
I'm a minister of my religion. This country has laws for ministers.
Mr. Muhammad Ali has just refused to be inducted into the United States Armed Forces.
It took an all-white jury less than a half hour to find Muhammad Ali guilty of all charges and specifications.
A different time, and a guy who goes from, well, nearly in prison, to one of the most beloved figures in American culture. Muhammad Ali died this week, and Rick Hogan's here. Good morning, buddy. Nice to see you.
It's sad. This is one of the most amazing lives. I was just talking to Dave Ennett about it. I can't imagine anybody getting this kind of deserved coverage. I mean, a lot of things are overblown in this world, in this life, but this is one that's not.
Well, Andrea and Mary aren't old enough, but you and I and Dave are.
Thank you, Steve.
To remember what a big deal Ali was. You know, there's famous, and then there's Ali.
No question.
Right? I
no
mean, you know, this is a Madonna.
And the one thing to remember, this is his huge fame was pre-internet, pre-Twitter, pre-Instagram. You're not having, you know, it used to be at O'Hare all the time. You didn't have thousands of shots of Muhammad Ali going all over the place. The people in the middle of Africa who revered and loved Ali did so in a different way than they revered and loved Michael Jordan. They had Michael Jordan t-shirts that someone had given them.
Right.
They didn't see him play.
Right.
But this guy transcended that.
Dave made a great point last hour with Chet, which I hadn't thought about in a long time. But obviously, as you said, all pre-internet. I remember, because it wasn't Chicago. I grew up in a small town in upstate New York.
Right, I know.
And when
great legendary football player, too.
Yeah, exactly. When I wanted to hear about the first fight back at Madison Square Garden, I had to wait for the paper the next day.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
You know, you had to wait for the paper to show up, and then you go read the paper, and you go, oh, look, he won.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine a world now
SportsCenter?
It's literally 12 hours after the events ended, and you still don't know the results?
But you look at the famous fight, the Rumble in the Jungle.
You look
at a few famous fights. It got pretty good coverage. There were hundreds of reporters there and hundreds of writers. Now it's inconceivable to me the kind of coverage this would get.
Yeah.
And he lived in Chicago for close to, you know, which people forget. There have been some nice stories about it, but he lived in Chicago for roughly 12 years.
Oh, I didn't know
that. He wanted to be close to Elijah Muhammad.
I mean, I knew he was here, but I didn't know it was for that long.
Well, I took, over the weekend, I took little Fiona, she's 11 years old.
She
didn't quite know
who
this was, but she's like so intrigued by him. We went over to his old house, 4944. South Woodlawn. It's still there. It's a beautiful mansion. A block from where Elijah Muhammad used to live, where Louis Farrakhan now lives.
Okay.
That was his last place. He had a little place in South Shore for a while. Then he had a penthouse apartment in South Shore. Then he moved one more time, I think, and then he moved into this remarkable house. And there were a number of people out there just looking at the house. They weren't leaving things. I didn't see anything left there. But people forget that he was here, and he was very visible here. He was very visible. I remember him going to Gene and Georgetti's, for goodness sake.
I was thinking, outside of Louisville, this is probably the other town he's identified with, right?
That's right, and his kids wound up living here, and then after he moved to L.A. and spent some time in L.A. with his then-second wife, who was from L.A., then he came back and lived in Berrien Springs, Michigan.
That's what I was going to ask you. I thought he had a place in Michigan.
No question. Yeah. He came back after he was in L.A., then he came back here, and he had close ties to Chicago. I didn't know him well, but for some time, my racquetball partner was a man named Cleve Walker,
okay,
who was Muhammad Ali's great friend and his only non-Muslim business advisor. One of the great moments in my life, we used to play with Jim Hoag, the Robert Redford lookalike editor of the Sun-Times, and a managing editor called Gregory Favre. We played every Friday. Cleve and I were teammates, and one day he comes in the locker room, he goes, that was a good game today. How would you boys like to go see the champ fight? And we're like, well, what do you mean? He goes, yeah, I have these tickets for you. Ringside tickets.
Come on.
To Muhammad Ali's second fight with Leon Spinks, September 1978, in the Superdome in New Orleans.
Come on.
And we went. We all went. How could you not
go?
How could you not go?
Of course.
How could you not go? And then, this is not a personal story. It's about Cleve Walker, who was one of the great people I've ever known. Cleve married a woman who worked for CPS in 1980, and Muhammad Ali was to be his best man. Muhammad Ali had just been beaten up by Larry Holmes pretty badly. So we're at McCormick Place in this very nice room, about 200 people, me and the racquetball partners and our various dates, and in walks Muhammad Ali. Very bruised, with a swollen face. And, of course, the crowd goes crazy with Instamatic cameras and things, and they rush up to him. And he gets up on the podium and says, please, this is the day for my friends Cleve and Belvon. I will be happy to take photos with you after this, if you just wait. Immediately, all the cameras went down. Everybody sat down. He was
how great is that?
He was great. He was great. He once... Another time, and Dave and I were just talking about, and Andrea, how he attracted a crowd wherever he went. One day, we're playing racquetball over here at the old Lakeshore Club, and it was Friday afternoon, like 5 o'clock. No one's ever there. And there's this huge bustle and noise. And who is standing above us, watching the four of us play racquetball, but Muhammad Ali and about every person who was doing sit-ups upstairs had rushed down to be near him. And we go, Cleve, what's he doing here? He goes, well, Champ and I are going to dinner after this. And we're like, okay.
So he just came over to meet Cleve.
Well, of course, he came to pick him up. Yeah, in his Rolls Royce.
Now, did he hang out in town? Did he have a restaurant that he preferred? Did he?
The only time I saw him, and the great thing was I never liked to intrude on him because so many people were there. I would always come up and say, Mr. Muhammad, Mr. Ali, I'm Cleve Walker's friend. And he'd always say, it happened three times, once at an airport, once at Gina Giorgetti's, and just, I think, on the street somewhere. And he goes, you're the racquetball player that Cleve carries on his back. And I said, yes, sir, that's right. you're absolutely right. Absolutely right.
And I'm told, because I never met him, but I'm told he always stared you in the eye when he talked to you.
No
the firm handshake.
Beyond firm.
But also you had that little glint in his eye. And if he gave you the needle, you were his friend.
Yeah. He and I never got into, you know, trading witticisms because I'd be way, way, way too intimidated.
He didn't do any rhymes? My name is Kogan. Yes, that's my name.
I still think his greatest poem, he was famous for his poems. I think he may have been at Harvard getting some award. And so some bright Harvard nerd, yuppie, pre-yuppie, get someone says, I wonder if you could do a really short poem. I mean, did you do that? And he said, me, we. Which I still think is among the most inspired poems I've ever heard in my life.
The most done with two words ever.
Yeah. I also want to just, I know you people have read tons of stuff, but Neil Steinberg has a great line in one of his pieces about Ali, and he's really right about this. He says, Cassius Clay was born in Kentucky, but Muhammad Ali was born on the south side of Chicago.
Yeah, about
that's
that.
Really true. He spent a lot of time at the Nation of Islam, used to. They may still have a bakery. I think it was on 69th Street. He was a real presence on the south side. He wasn't, he wasn't down here parading the avenue and shopping at the...
Did he have a relationship with Farrakhan?
Pardon me? Oh, yeah.
Ali?
I think so. He must have. But
there was a break with Malcolm X.
Yes.
And after the break with Malcolm X and the violent rhetoric from Malcolm X, and after obviously Malcolm X was killed, there was a break. So I wondered if the Farrakhan rhetoric turned him off in some way.
Can't tell because I don't think he was as verbally ambulatory
as
he was.
That's true.
And one very interesting thing is the day that Malcolm X was assassinated, a fire of mysterious origins burned Ali's home.
Is that right?
Same day. So that begs a ton of questions. Another piece you people should read, and I had forgotten about this. It's at RogerEbert.com. It is about the day in 1977. Roger Ebert, the esteemed film critic for the Sun Times, if you people don't know. He was in Los Angeles. He took Muhammad Ali, after Muhammad Ali's appearance on The Tonight Show, hosted by Diana Ross, to see Rocky II. He went with his wife and his little daughter.
Hold on a second. He took Ali to Rocky?
Yes.
How great is that night?
Well, the whole piece is fabulous because Ali is giving commentary. He went with his wife and his little then baby daughter, Hannah. They went to it. The whole piece is great, but here is the best part of it. Muhammad Ali got up carefully so as not to wake Hannah and handed his daughter to Veronica. A great movie, he said, a big hit. It has all the ingredients, love, violence, emotion. The excitement never dulled. Then Roger asked him, what do you think about the way the fight turned out? Ali said, for the black man to come out superior would be against America's teachings. I have been so great in boxing, they have to create an image like Rocky, a white image on the screen to counteract my image in the ring. America has to have its white images no matter where it gets them. Jesus, Wonder Woman, Tarzan, and Rocky. That is one of the most spectacular quotes I've ever heard, and it sounds just like him.
Yeah, and you know what? You could argue it.
Huh?
You could argue it. You could absolutely argue it.
I'm not going to argue it.
No, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I can't. I actually can't argue that point.
Rick Kogan. Here you go. I was talking earlier about Kopic. Here's your walking, talking historian right here.
Sure.
Right. This is the first library. This is your Chicago library right there. great to see you, buddy.
You too.
Stand by. Bill and Wendy in for me at 9. We'll take a break for traffic here on 720 WGN.